Denise Lowe, Native American of Delaware heritage, is a former Kansas Poet Laureate. Denise, I am so looking forward to hearing your selections. What are you sharing with us tonight?
Well, several things from the High Plains, and thanks for that lovely introduction. History winds itself around all the different kinds of poets and poetry that, and literatures that come out of this region. And especially, I think of the life stories, the personal stories. We read history like Empire of the Comanche Moon, but when Cynthia Parker, Quanah Parker, when those personalities enter into the story, they become more real. I want to read you a poem I wrote about Moki, who is a Cheyenne woman who was one of the Cheyenne women warriors. And it is called Cheyenne Country. The afterlife starts as a snowscape folded into alto stratus clouds, solid as foothill roads traversed by Cheyennes. Sand Creek's story is a braided yellow quirt. Moki sees soldiers murder her mother. She takes her grandfather's rifle and shoots. Winter gales resound with her thunder. Wind's oration calls to all directions. Breeding season for hawks is early spring, when hatchlings hunger, feathered talons drop from blue heights and kill. Moki shot Shivington's soldier before he raped her. She killed Lydia German, a settler mother. Stories in these hills belong to Moki. So that is a poem about this woman who became very well known for her ferocity, and she was traumatized. I think part of the story is at Sand Creek she was traumatized, and trauma is part of the legacy of this history. And I'm going to read After Genocide, that I have written more with Delaware people in mind as we became immigrants out to the plains in refuge from the various tragedies we experienced. After genocide, we find ourselves on a bare plain, neighbors shocked silent. At last, one man speaks. The village was by the Mississippi. When the killing ended, two toddlers cried under a cook pot. The army recruit did not bayonet the girls, but instead defied guns trained at his back. He took them and moved west. The soldier was his grandfather. The younger baby was his mother. Cold winter nights, we sit in taverns, numbing our minds. We tell stories about horses and whirlwinds, or sit silent. North wind drones war songs. Anyone left by springtime is a friend, but sun streams from another god's heaven. The children do not ask about grandparents. We tell them nothing about Jackson's soldiers or Paspaheg, Nadenhuden, Yahoo Falls, Horseshoe Bend, Washita, Wounded Knee. Why they dream of turtles buried deep in mud. We tell them to hush. Don't ask for much. So this is another poem that kind of suggests the trauma that people experience. And this is a historic trauma that continues through generations, and I think it is something not particular only to Native people. I think it is something that Native people certainly have, in this part of the country, a very recent history of. And I'm turning to the poet Stuart Howa, who is Comanche, with his permission, and I'm going to read from his portion of his poem, Dismantled Horses, from his book, Black Knife, which is online at the Squaw National Research Center at the University of Arkansas, Little Rock. And this is a poem about instead of horses, there are cars in the contemporary Comanche life. What is left of the burning barrels and the buffalo chips that fueled our dreams is at the end of your cigarette, the only light within 5 miles. The stars are not out tonight. Night is just the smell of burning tobacco. Comanche County ends on a gravel road underneath a pickup truck. We lie cross-legged with the dark, stealing different tribal license plates and reinventing horse-stealing songs with screwdrivers. And when you inhale, we exist only as an orange glow within a manhood built out of these stolen plates. For you, morning will be tribal princesses being carried away by yellow beads sewed in the shape of horse legs. For me, it's bolts and pins of dismantled horses. The mercy is where sunlight, like brilliant swords in diagonal swing, takes us by the neck. So that was Dismantled Horses by Cy Howa. Vietnam is another time when, and World War II, both of these wars are times when we understood more about the historic trauma and the term, post-traumatic stress syndrome was coined and has become something, a way to articulate some of the difficulties that have plagued people. And so that is something in A Strong West Wind. The other book that we're discussing today is where we are headed to with this. And I will open with just one sentence that typifies for me some of the beauty of the writing and also this topic. It also introduces to this topic. What none of these stories or subtexts explains is my father's cussedness about the psychological consequences or aftermath of war.
Thank you so much, Denise. As you said, the final book of the 2016 Spring Radio Reader Book Club is Gail Caldwell's A Strong West Wind. And the online book discussion guides provide profiles and perspectives of our radio readers, including our next discussion leader, and that is Alex Hunt of Canyon, Texas. Alex?
Hi, this is Alex back with you. We're going to talk now about Gail Caldwell's memoir, A Strong West Wind. This is, of the three books, perhaps the oddball. I think it's a nice compliment in being a memoir, a different genre than the other two books. It's also interesting to me in that it provides us some challenges in thinking about sense of place, because even as it's really strongly steeped in sense of place, as Caldwell grows up in Amarillo, in the Texas Panhandle, it's also a story of trying to get away. So there's a real antipathy toward place, mixed feelings to say the least. And so it puts the idea of place in some tension. She references a lot of literature in this book, in part, I think, because literature is for Gail Caldwell, especially as a young girl, her first form of escape. It's her way of leaving the world of the high plains without being able to really go anywhere. And one of the authors that she refers to is Thomas Wolfe, who's famous for saying something more or less like, "You can never go home again." But this book, to me, raises the question, it's a little bit different, a little bit turned inside out, of whether you can ever escape where you're from. And it seems to me, even as Caldwell moves off from Amarillo, first just to Lubbock, but then to Austin, and then further, ultimately, to Boston, where she becomes the chief literary critic of the Boston Globe, it seems to me that she can never really shake her roots and where she's from. And indeed, the book begins and ends in Amarillo, in the beginning with her childhood and at the end in returning after her father's death. So it's a sense of being haunted by place, I think, that comes very powerfully through Caldwell's book. A sense of having been shaped by wind, and wherever she is later in life, she experiences hardship as impending storms and tornadoes. So she succeeds in getting away, but she never is able to exercise that sense of place that shaped her early on.
For sure. This is a book about her leaving the plains, but it's also a book about the plains staying inside her after she leaves. The question is why she had to leave. And I wrote a book bite about this book, and in that book bite, I said that we've all known people as people who live on the high plains, and I'm one of these people who have left, but we've all known creative people or misfits or oddballs who left. Sometimes we never see them again, and sometimes we see them, as I said, 6 months later, looking bedraggled, and they drag themselves back up onto the high plains, and they've had their hat handed to them in Austin or New York City or Chicago. But the question is, what is it about the high plains that makes creative people feel they need to leave to see the place, not just to leave, period, but also often when they leave, as Willa Cather did from New York City writing about Nebraska, why do they have to leave to see this place more clearly? So I guess that's my question.
Well, one part of this is the center of the publishing business is in New York City. It's not on the High Plains.
Well, but you don't have to live in New York City to be a writer.
You used to, and you have advantages if you do live there.
Well, that's certainly, I mean, Speaking as someone who was a writer living in New York City, we all know there are a million writers living in Brooklyn. However, at the publishing company I worked at, almost, they didn't all live in New York City. They lived all over the place, I think and I'm not just talking about writers here. I'm talking about musicians and actors. And obviously you want to go where the industry is, but there are places that foster creativity maybe better than the High Plains. And why is that? I mean, I think you can incubate your creativity here, but at some point you have to leave. And when you leave, often so many of these people end up writing about this place. But I think for some reason it's hard to see it from inside of it.
I think you're asking two questions.
Maybe.
One is, does the creative person have to leave home to see home in some sort of realistic perspective, proportion, perception, and so on? And on the other hand, is home a nurturing place? Does it, in fact, encourage this? And sometimes the answer is yes, sometimes the answer is no. On the other hand, the previous question about having to leave, I can speak to that myself, having lived in cities, Washington, D.C., Dallas, Kansas City, and so on. Sometimes the ability to see so far on the plains can obscure things, too, and we don't see them with as much clarity, where I think getting away allows that clarity to return. George O'Keefe talked about the dry Southwest as being the faraway nearby. She was speaking specifically to New Mexico, but the same kind of aridity that Alex was talking about earlier lends itself to a peculiar kind of light out here. And we've talked a lot about being able to see, but perhaps the creative person, that clarity becomes an obstacle in its own self. And not being able to see things in as they really are, feeding into denial and so on about like historical details we've been talking about sugarcoating and so on and mythologies. Maybe I'm getting a little too weird, but
no. But I think there is another element to it, and I'll quite frankly say that I think sometimes people who are different are made to feel unwelcome here.
I think there's probably a lot to explore there, but I was just going through my mental Rolodex. And again, speaking to the American literary tradition, Franklin, Jefferson, Washington Irving, Hemingway, Gertrude Stein, Nathaniel Hawthorne, have I left anyone else out? They all felt the need to leave the East Coast, if you will. Hemingway, of course, the Midwest, because they couldn't develop their creativity in the United States, so they spent time abroad. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, too, if there's a larger issue that you're looking at.
Yeah, Thomas Wolfe left, you know, South Carolina to go to
Is it just High Plains people or Midwesterners, or is it something about American culture overall that tends to stymie at least the literary creativity?
I'm not sure it's the stymieing or the perception of being stymied, quite frankly.
I think that's a good distinction.
I think that there's this fear of being seen as provincial. That's the most provincial thing that you can do, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. And I think that what some see as a burden, perhaps Gail Caldwell, the burden of having grown up in Amarillo, is in fact misperceived as the loyalty that I see, loyalty to sense of place that I see all around me in the places that place that I live. And I have to recognize when something seeped into my bones, because then when it's in your bones, you can't get rid of it. And in my case, I don't want to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. I want those things in my bones forever. And I think Gail Caldwell, there's the conundrum for her, is that I think she felt like she was supposed to be to deny her Amarillo-ness. For lack of a better way of putting it, she's always going to be Gail Caldwell from Amarillo, Texas, regardless whether she lives in Boston or not. Especially in Amarillo, Texas, that's how mm-hmm. she's seen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've had performers like Sid Charisse,
right,
famous dancer, who was the daughter of the guy who owned the jewelry store on, mm-hmm. on Polk Street in Amarillo. She adopts a new name, as they all did back in the day, of course. But could she have always been Sid Charisse in Amarillo? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not.
Yeah.
So.
I don't think there's much question that small communities, isolated communities that are very conservative can be oppressive to people that don't seem to fit in. And different people can navigate that with more success than others. But I think it's worth remembering the historical context as well. And Caldwell kind of, in a pretty compelling way, I thought, equates her own coming of age to the cultural shift of the 60s. So part of her Declaration of Independence and her need to get away is also part of that whole cultural revolution of the 1960s.
She certainly makes us believe that she needs to get out of Amarillo to become who she wants to be. And, I would say there's a tradition of tolerating eccentrics that, as I look back on growing up in my small community in the Flint Hills, was somewhat fostered, but there was also some stratification, stultification that was difficult. But this book, to me, reads like two separate books. The first half is about how I grew up and left Amarillo and went to Austin and became a hippie and a war protester. And then she takes that thread of the war protest into how I came back and talked to my dad about the war, World War II, and resolved our conflict about the Vietnamese War.
I'd almost venture to say there are three books. And yeah. The part in Breckenridge is a completely separate part of that. And that's the way I see it, because it's not true West Texas. It's on what they call the edge of the west edge of the hill country in Texas. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a third part.
Okay.
That ought to be considered, because there is the aunt there who has the books in her room, the forbidden books, for
that's
example.
Right.
You know, is it a substitute Amarillo Public Library that she moves to Breckenridge when she stays there? You know, so there are three different dynamics, I think, going on. And the other thing I'd speak to is what Amarillo was in the 50s. It's post-World War II. Her father's a veteran, a big part of his character. But Amarillo Air Base, which brought so many military people, it shut down briefly until we moved into the Cold War part when they built it back up. It was closed. And so all these military people are bringing things into Amarillo that's not really addressed. This idea of Amarillo being so isolated, but it's always been pass-through country. It's always been a truck stop, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
And there have always been, I mean, even from peoples on foot passing through Amarillo, on the way to Alabates Flint's quarries to trade, and then they come on horses, and then they come in wheeled vehicles, and then they come in aeroplanes. It's all things have been cross-pollinated in there for centuries, ever since there have been human beings. And so,
do you think that the landscape, though, maybe lends itself to that that perception of it as a truck stop or as a way station of some kind? And does that maybe lend itself to an urge for people to want to be on the move from the place? Or I guess I'm tying it back into Empire of the Summer Moon a little bit here. The Comanche were constantly on the move, and that made sense here. And once people start drilling, either for water or mm-hmm. for oil, mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to put this, but are you disagreeing with the land somehow by saying I'm going to drill into this place and stay put in a place that almost every part of it, from the wind to the flatness, is asking you move on, keep going?
Personally, I think it begins with fencing.
Yeah,
compartmentalizing that part of the West, and therefore laying claim to it, because the open range time is simply a change in the culture of the people on horseback. They're no longer Comanches; they're cowboys, and their time was limited until the Finches show up, and then
very limited.
It's a very short period.
35 years.
Yeah. And even the trail drives only last for 15 years. But then when they bring in barbed wire, then the drilling for water, then the other things that come along, and not nurturing the land so much, taking what it offered, but digging for it. You know, there's the old saw about in on the high plains, you dig, what is it, you climb for water and dig for oil. I can't remember what it was, but it's just back. No, you dig for wood and you climb for water. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
And so
your description brings to mind somebody told me once, I think a professor probably, mentioning that, you know, culture, the arts, painting, sculpture, music, writing, those are all activities that take time, mm-hmm. That take leisure time. And in listening to you talk about the development of Amarillo, and I'm thinking about our fictional community of Holt, too. In Holt, they have time, it seems. A lot of those characters have time, and they spend it at the bar or the American Legion Hall. But in terms of just having the time respite from hard work, doesn't always seem to have been the case in our part of the country. So I wonder if in years to come we'll have that time or the incentive, the desire to then turn our attention to developing that. And I guess we'll think about that a little bit more while we go to the next component. Thank you.
I'm Lynn Boitano, and you are listening to a special live presentation of the spring finale for the Radio Readers Book Club. Our final musical selections are drawn from Caldwell's A Strong West Wind. Caldwell's memoir portrayed a sense of place in both time and location, with music as a punctuation mark. Caldwell's readers will remember the country song Amarillo by Morning, juxtaposed with the counterculture soul song War in A Strong West Wind.
Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio. Everything that I got is just what I've got on. When that sun is high in that Texas sky, I'll be bucking at the county fair. Amarillo by morning, Amarillo, I'll be there. They took my saddle in Houston, broke my leg in Santa Fe, lost my wife and a girlfriend, somewhere along the way. But I'll be looking for aid when they pull that gate, and I hope that judge ain't blind. Amarillo by morning, Amarillo's on my mind. Amarillo by morning, up from San Antonio. Everything that I got is just what I've got. What I got is mine. I ain't rich, but Lord, I'm free. Amarillo by morning, Amarillo's where I'll be. Amarillo by morning, Amarillo's where I'll be.
Say it again. War. Ooh, 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 ooh.
Edwin Starr and War, and we started off with Amarillo by Morning from George Strait. We have time for just a few closing remarks from our panel. Jane?
Thank you so much for joining us for our fantastic conversation about the Radio Reader's Spring Read. We're going to hear from each of the panelists a few final comments about the books, about our experiences. Alex?
Well, these are hard books to sum up as a trio. I guess I would just say that as I've become somewhat native to the High Plains, part of what I've come to appreciate about it is it's just a tough environment. Even the wind and having to sort of fight against the wind sometimes is invigorating. It's like the environment itself is a challenge on a daily basis. And so it makes me think that these three books are, in one way of looking at them, is they're about three different cultures or cultural moments of people trying to live in this environment. And I think we're pretty used to thinking in very traditional ways about a progression or evolution of human society that leads sort of unerringly to agriculture as the apex of it. And of course, as we think about the Ogallala Aquifer and some of the issues involved with sustainability, I think it raises interesting questions about how different cultures have made use of the land in different ways in different periods. Also, all of these books, as we've talked about, they're interestingly about movement, about coming and going and moving across the landscape. And I have to come back to the idea of the Comanches and their adaptation of nomadism as a way of living on the High Plains. It's an interesting question. That history poses an interesting question to us as we have settled on the High Plains and turned it into an agricultural empire what is the future?
Thank you, Alex. Denise?
Those are good comments, and it makes me think back on these books and how we are living in evolving histories. There are histories of the native people who are continuing to live here and evolve. There are Spanish-speaking people who are entering this history again and weaving back and forth from Comancheria times into the present time. And then there is the English language that is filled with stories that are pulling us all together through these books. And I'd like to end with something Gail Caldwell wrote very beautifully. She said, "Stories have always been the hymns of history."
Wonderful. Thank you. Michael?
Well, I'm humbled to be on a panel with such auspicious scholars and professors and teachers and writers. And the only thing I would say is that, barring from a strong west wind, when I first moved to Canyon, I wrote to my grandfather in Marysville, Kansas, and I said, and he was a farmer, and I said, "Grandpa, all the trees point east-northeast here because the wind's always out of the west-southwest." And I'm reminded what wind does, and wind changes things. And so things are in constant states of flux on the High Plains, perhaps more than other parts of the country. And so as peoples were supplanted, Antelope Creek people supplanted by the Apaches, supplanted by the Comanches, supplanted by Euro-Americans later on, perhaps there's more supplanting to happen, and the wind is there to remind us.
That's beautiful. Beautiful, Lynn?
Since Michael's talking about wind and harshness on the prairie, I found a comment from Brenda from Canyon, Texas, and she says it's a very tough place to bring the comforts of home to. Much has happened in a little time over 100 years, and we certainly have learned the hard way not to try to change things too much. My own sister-in-law, who lives in Connecticut, came out to visit and took a tour of our feedlots and our dairies, and her comment was, on the way back to her plane, was, "It's a harsh, harsh life you live out here."
Well, this was fun, and I had a great time talking with all of you. there are some brilliant people in this room, and it always it's nice to just I'm constantly reminded of how clever and interesting the people from this place that I call home are. These three books seem on their face like they couldn't be more dissimilar. We have a novel and we have a work of history and we have a memoir. One is set in the 19th century, one is set in the present day, and one is set during the turmoil of the 1960s and in the 1950s. But they have a lot to do with one another once you start digging into them. There's a lot of coming and going, whether it's Victoria in Plain Song going off to Denver and not finding her place there and returning to the High Plains and there finding her place, or whether it's Cynthia Ann Parker having the opposite experience, really going to the High Plains, finding her place, and then being extricated and forced back into a community where she didn't belong and didn't want to be, and ultimately that killed her. Whether it's Gail Caldwell, who never really found her place growing up in the High Plains and left for good, but then found herself writing about this place. So maybe living still on the High Plains inside her mind. But for me, all of these books are about adaptation. Whether it's the old rancher men in Plain Song who are learning to adapt to a young pregnant girl living in their house, or whether it's the Comanche who were, as I said, short, squatty, unremarkable men, and then they got onto horses and they adapted and suddenly they were the most fearsome horsemen in the history of the world, or whether it's Quanah Parker learning to adapt in multiple ways throughout his life, or whether it's Gail Caldwell, learning to adapt to her own sort of knowledge of or need to live inside books and in a changing world. So I love these books, and I think they were great choices, and I had fun today.
I just want to thank everyone for being on the panel today and for everyone who's participated in the book club this spring. I think the best part about a book club is being able to share perspectives and insights and about what we're reading, and to challenge each other's perceptions and maybe conceptions. I feel it's wonderful to have this regional approach in a book talk. I think each of us has seen ourselves in each of the books that we've read. I've learned for sure a lot about the history of the High Plains from reading the book about the Comanche. And Gail Caldwell gave me a new insight into growing up at that particular time in our country's history. And as far as the novel, it has a special hold on me, I think, for the way Harif describes a particular small town. And so we look forward to our next reading endeavor, which will kick off in August as we explore borders and new beginnings.
Well, thank you so much for listening. I'm Lynn Boitano for the High Plains Public Radio Radio Readers Book Club. Thank you to our panel, Jane Holwerda from Dodge City, Alex Hunt, Jonathan Baker, and Michael Grauer from Canyon, Texas, Denise Lowe, former Kansas Poet Laureate, and Lynn Hughes from Cimarron, Kansas. Thanks to the Radio Readers and Book Club steering members, with a special thanks to the Southwest Kansas Library System for technical assistance and support. Funding for the HPPR Radio Readers Book Club was provided by Long Fromm of Colby, Kansas, and by the Kansas Humanities Council, a nonprofit organization that supports community-based cultural programs and serves as a financial resource through an active grant-making program and encourages Kansans to engage in the civic and cultural lives of their communities. For more information on the Radio Readers Book Club's upcoming events and seasons, you can find that at hppr.org. I'm Lynn Boitano, and thanks so much for being with us tonight.
$10,000. 1,000 words swarm around my head, 10 million more in books written beneath my bed. I wrote or read them all, went searching in the swarm, still can't find how to hold my hands. And I know you need me in the next room over, but I am stuck in here all paralyzed. For months I got myself in ruts, too much time spent in mirrors framed in yellow walls. Ain't it like most people, I'm no different. Love to talk on things we don't know about.